From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Neil Conan. Terry Gross is on vacation. On today's Fresh Air, a story of tragedy and survival at sea, the USS Indianapolis. Nearly 900 U.S. sailors were cast into the sea when the ship was torpedoed in 1945. Only 317 survived hypothermia, dehydration, and shark attacks. The Navy blamed the ship's captain for the disaster. Last month, after decades of effort by his crew, the captain was officially exonerated. We talk with Paul Murphy, chairman of the Indianapolis Survivors Association, and his former shipmate, Harold Bray. Also, film critic John Powers reviews the new thriller, The Deep End. That's coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Frank Stacio. Some medical researchers say they are unhappy with President Bush's decision to limit funding for stem cell research. They say the call could end up depriving people of the medical help they need. While scientists wanted the president to go farther, some church groups say he went too far. Roman Catholic leaders say the move is morally unacceptable. U.S. and British coalition aircraft today struck targets in Iraq's southern no-fly zone. U.S. officials say the targets posed a threat to coalition air patrols intended to protect ethnic populations in northern and southern Iraq. NPR's Vicky O'Hara reports.
Defense officials say that about 50 planes, including 20 strike aircraft, hit military communications, radar, and anti-missile installations. Lieutenant Colonel Jim Yontz is a spokesman for the U.S. Central Command in Tampa, Florida.
These strikes in the no-fly zones are executed as a self-defense measure in response to Iraqi hostile threats and acts against coalition forces and their aircraft.
Iraq has been increasingly aggressive in challenging coalition patrols. Last month, according to U.S. officials, an Iraqi missile came close to hitting a high-altitude U.S. reconnaissance plane. Today's airstrike was the second against Iraq this week. Iraq's official news agency says it killed one person and wounded 11 others. U.S. officials say all coalition aircraft returned safely. Vicki O'Hara, NPR News, Washington.
Three New York City police officers were fired today. They were among those who allegedly had been drinking with Officer Joseph Gray, the policeman under investigation for the drunken driving accident that killed three people in Brooklyn. Gray was arraigned today in Brooklyn court. NPR's Margot Adler reports.
Shortly after the arraignment of Officer Joseph Gray on manslaughter charges, New York Police Commissioner Bernard Kerik announced the firings of three of the 17 officers who had been drinking with Gray at an off-limits, corruption-prone Brooklyn strip club before Gray ran the three victims down. The four other officers who were also accused of drinking with Gray were either transferred, suspended without pay, or were assigned to desk duty. Commissioner Kerik also made changes in police procedures regarding the staffing of midnight tours at all city precincts. Now, any officer on disciplinary probation will be removed from the shift and placed in a setting with more supervisors. Meanwhile, at his arraignment, Officer Joseph Gray pleaded innocent and was released on $250,000 bail. Margot Adler, NPR News, New York.
Negotiators failed to overcome U.S. objections to the agenda for a conference on racism in South Africa. The United States has said it will not attend the Durban conference unless Arab states drop demands that Israel be labeled a racist occupying power for its treatment of the Palestinians. The U.S. also objects to language that would require compensation and an apology for racism. On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average rose 117 points to 10,416. The Nasdaq was down 7. You're listening to National Public Radio News. Space Shuttle Discovery flew into orbit today on a mission to deliver fresh crew to the International Space Station. The shuttle carried 7 crew members. 3 of them will swap places with the current space station crew. NASA launched the spaceship 5 minutes earlier than planned because of thunderstorms moving in from the south. Relief is on the way for the Northeast, where sizzling heat gripped the nation for a week. From member station WBUR in Boston, Steve Sine reports.
Strong thunderstorms rolled through New England and caused some minor flooding, but they were welcomed by baked Bostonians. Highs Friday were in the mid-90s, a few degrees less than the day before when the mercury pushed up near 100 degrees. No temperature records were broken in Boston, but electricity usage in New England hit all-time highs on consecutive days. A power conservation warning was lifted Friday afternoon. However, power problems persist. Thousands of Boston residents remain without power due to electrical substation fires. Cooling shelters remain open, and public pools are free and open late as residents look forward to a weekend featuring highs in the 70s. For NPR News, I'm Steve Sein in Boston.
The Justice Department is urging a federal appeals court to quickly set the penalties against Microsoft for antitrust violations. In a court filing, the department says dragging out the court case would further delay the public's remedy and contribute to uncertainty in the market. The appeals judges have already ruled Microsoft repeatedly broke antitrust law. They were scheduled today to send the case to a new judge for the penalty phase. Microsoft asked the judge to halt legal actions in the case as the software giant waits to hear if the U.S. Supreme Court will step in and take a look. I'm Frank Stasio, National Public Radio News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Kaiser Family Foundation, providing online summaries of daily developments in health policy and webcasts of congressional hearings at kaisernetwork.org.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Neil Conan, sitting in for Terry Gross. The USS Indianapolis is one of the great and tragic stories of the sea, an epic of survival, heroism, and self-sacrifice. Near the end of the Second World War, the Navy sent the Indianapolis alone across the Philippine Sea and failed to notice when the heavy cruiser never arrived in port. Torpedoes from a Japanese submarine sank the ship in less than 15 minutes. The Navy blamed the ship's captain, Charles McVeigh, for the disaster, but his shipmates and historians long argued that McVeigh was a scapegoat. A series of blunders led to the ship's destruction, and the Navy covered up its mistakes. Last month, the U.S. Navy officially exonerated Captain McVeigh. About 900 men spilled into the oily water when their ship went down around midnight. Just 317 were alive when rescue finally arrived 5 days later. I spoke with two survivors of the Indianapolis earlier this year, Paul Murphy, who's now the head of the Survivors Organization, and Harold Bray, who was asleep on deck when the torpedoes hit.
That was my first night on the topside. My regular sleeping quarters were three decks down forward around sick bay. And I don't know why I slept up there that night. But I'm glad I did.
And this was just at about midnight. Harold, did you realize that they were torpedoes at first?
Oh, no, sir. When I woke up, I looked up. I was underneath the number one and number two gun turret sleeping. And then when I woke up, I looked up and saw the fire coming out of the stack, number one stack. And I really did. I thought a boiler blew or... Of course, being new in the Navy, I didn't know what could have happened. I never expected a torpedo.
You were 17 years old at the time.
Yes, sir.
And just in the Navy, it couldn't have been more than a few months.
Well, I enlisted in December of 1944, and I went into boot camp in January of 1945.
And so did you... turn to somebody and say, you know, what's going on?
No, I had my dungarees on, no shirt on, and my shoes were off. So I reached for my shoes, and when I did, I saw them slip over the side or down to the lower deck or somewhere. But I was barefoot. And then I started to go down to my battle station, which was three decks down and couldn't get down there. On account of fire and smoke. So I continued aft through the port hangar deck. I got to the rear of the hangar deck, and there was somebody in the carpenter shop throwing out his life jacket, so I grabbed one and continued aft to the fantail.
Paul Murphy, you were asleep. Did the explosion of the torpedoes wake you up?
Yes, I was blown out of my bunk, and I quickly grabbed my clothes and shoes and dressed, and went to my general quarters station, which was in the after part of the ship.
Now, at this time, was the alarm for general quarters going off around the ship?
No, there was no power to do anything on the ship. When the torpedoes hit, it knocked out all intercoms aboard ship.
And if there's no power, it's black.
That's right. It was black. Pretty black, and I went to my general quarters station, which is the after control tower, and that was the tower that controlled the 8-inch guns. And when I opened that door up, a friend of mine from California by the name of Paul Mitchell was lying there sound asleep, and I woke him up, gave him a life jacket, and told him to go to his general quarters station. Later, I found out that Paul did get off of the ship, but he died about 2 or 3 days later. I never saw him in the water, however.
At that time, what did you think had happened?
Well, I knew something had hit us. Didn't know whether it was torpedoes or gunnery or what, but everything that happened was forward of where I was. I couldn't see that the bow had been blown off, nor that the second torpedo exploded under the number one turret. But the ship very quickly started listing to the starboard side.
Just turning over, starting to turn over.
Right, and when it reached about 40, 45 degrees, the 5-inch guns that were on the deck below where I was were covered with water. So when I left the ship, all I did was step off and swim with a life jacket on, and I had an extra one with me when I went over the side. And I swam probably 75 to 100 yards, looked back, and then I saw the ship completely turn over on its top, and the stern was standing straight up in the air with the propellers or screws still turning. And then it disappeared.
You could see that silhouetted against the stars?
Yes.
Harold Bray, we left you on the fantail with your life jacket.
Yes, well, when I got there, there was one of the sailors was hurt pretty bad, and I gave him my life jacket and went back and got another one. And by the time I got back to the fantail, whoever I gave it to was gone. And I was hanging on to the lifeline, and the ship was really listing badly at the time. So there was another sailor by the name, I can't remember his name, but we call him Frenchie. And he escaped from France, I guess, from the Germans, and joined our Navy to get into the war, and he kept saying, "You better go over, Bray, you better go." I said, "No, she's not going down." So finally I climbed over the lifeline, and by that time the mast was in the water. She was laying flat on her side, and I ran down the side of the ship back towards the quarterdeck, and that's where I went off. It was still about a 30 or 40 foot drop. And when I hit the water, somebody hit me and drove me down. I don't know how far I went down. But then I happened to open my eyes to come back up, and I see this big black spot. I said, "Oh, man, it's just coming down on top of me." But it happened to be oil slick on the water, and I came to the surface and started swimming away, and wrapped my arm around a what they call a floater net. It was still bundled up. There was a sailor sitting on top of it. And we finally got that, and I looked back and...
This would have been like a cargo net, but with cork in it?
Yes, it was like 1 foot square with cork. And it was like maybe Paul would know the size. It was like maybe...
About 10 by 20 or something like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, something like that, 24-foot squares. And before that, I looked back, and the ship was up on her bow and going down. And there were still guys coming off of it, falling, I don't know, that would be hundreds of feet when she was on her bow and coming down. And there were still guys coming off, like looked like a bunch of ants coming off of the ship.
What were you hearing at that time? What did it sound like?
A lot of banging and There was a couple little explosions. I thought something inboard of the ship was exploding. And but as far as they always said, swim away from her, I never felt any suction or anything. I was only maybe 100 yards from her when she went under.
What group did you join when you went off the ship?
Well, when we went off at midnight, a little after midnight, there was oil slick on the water, and we all swallowed oil and salt water, and we spent most of the night vomiting. We didn't know where we were that night because it was so dark, but we all were waiting forward to the sunrise the next day so we could gather around and determine where we were and what to expect. And the next morning, we found that there were 3 cargo nets in my group and 2 life rafts. And we tied those cargo nets together and eventually got the life rafts tied in there, too. So we were in the largest group that went together and tried to stay together.
Harold, when we last left you, you were on a cargo net with one other man.
Well, we unrolled it. We untied it somehow. I don't know. I can't remember how we did that, but I don't know if the other sailor had a knife or what, but we got it unraveled and floating out, and then we started picking up people that were around. And I don't remember where the raft came from, but we did tie up with a raft and a couple of more of the floater nets.
Paul Murphy, the sun comes up that first day. You realize, obviously, a tremendous, you know, obviously the ship has sunk. There's a tremendous amount of injured men. And what do you think is going on? Are you talking to officers on the ship at that point?
No, there wasn't too many officers around. There was a couple of them that were trying to give us a hard time. But they didn't have any more training for this than we did. So what we tried to do is keep those rafts together. My division was a Fox division. We tried to take care of each other. We had quite a few of those boys together. And the ones that were put on the rafts were generally somebody that was injured pretty badly and needed to be out as much of the water as possible. Now, those rafts didn't protect you much from water because they had sides that were hemp rope, and they had a open platform on the bottom. So they were probably waist deep in the water, where the rest of us that stayed in our life jackets were shoulder height there at the beginning. But it was a major warship, and we were very optimistic that we would be missed, if not any later than the next day, because on Tuesday afternoon, we were due into Leyte, and surely they'd be looking for us by that time.
Leyte, the port in the Philippines, that was your destination.
Right. And, of course, each day passed, and it became very obvious that no one was looking for us. We saw planes fly over us every day, but they were up probably 20 or 25,000 feet. There was no way they could see us. We tried to buoy each other up, and we prayed, and we encouraged each other, and eventually we were spotted. But it was. There's no way that we can tell you exactly how bad it was. The way to find out is to talk to the men that picked us up. They could tell you. They were mentally alert and able to tell you exactly how we looked and what we appeared like and everything, but it was tremendous. And this was a beautiful ship. This was a famous ship. It was a flagship of the Fifth Fleet, and somebody's going to be looking for us. And each day we were more optimistic than the day before.
Harold Bray, somebody always organizes a sing-along.
Yeah. There wasn't much singing that I could remember.
They organized prayers.
Yeah, that's about it. But, well, I stayed pretty much to myself. I was brand new on a ship, as I told you before, and I went on board with maybe about 12 to 20 men from my boot company. And I didn't know Paul until we started using or having our reunions, and I got acquainted with most of the remainder of the crew. But out of my boot camp company, I think there was four of us survived the sinking, and today I think there's two of us left now. One is in a hospital in Milwaukee, and then there's me, so.
Harold Bray and Paul Murphy, shipmates on the USS Indianapolis, which was torpedoed and sunk in the South Pacific in 1945. Only 317 men survived the disaster. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Now let's continue our conversation with Harold Bray and Paul Murphy, who survived the sinking of the USS Indianapolis. Let me take you back, though, to that first day. You're full of optimism that within a few minutes you're going to see a plane looking for you or a ship come up over the horizon. Was it hot? Were you starting to experience, at that point, dehydration?
It got pretty warm during the day. But the fuel oil that we had on us protected us from those of us that didn't have shirts or pants, or the oil protected us from the elements as far as the heat goes. But it got pretty cold at night, though. There's nothing to protect you from that.
Was it clear at night?
By the most part, it was after the sinking of the ship. That night was pretty dark, but we had breaks in the clouds where the moon would come out once in a while. But after that, as I remember it, it was pretty clear. You could see stars at night.
And again, the sound, were people praying? Were people talking to themselves?
Yeah, they did a lot of talking to themselves and a lot of praying. There wasn't much, I didn't have much conversations with other people, but we helped each other. I hung on to this, what turned out to be a Marine. We carried, I think it was, what was it, Paul, 78 Marines on there?
No, 39.
Oh, 39. Uh-huh. Well, anyhow, seven of them survived. I hung on to this one Marine for a couple of days. He was floating around with his mouth open, and he was getting pretty well bloated, and I tried to tie him to the net so he wouldn't float away, and I think I did that, but he disappeared the last night. I never did see him again, so he must have, the knot probably wasn't very good.
Paul Murphy, the heat during the day, you must have been at that point, you know, you couldn't wait for sundown.
Well, as the days passed and our condition weakened and we were acclimating ourselves to the salt water and the dehydration and so forth, but eventually the sun was so blistering during the daytime that it started affecting our faces especially, and a lot of the boys, including myself, I cut my shirt tail off, and of course Harold didn't have one, but I cut my shirt tail off and put over my head during the daytime. And it was so warm and tropical that we looked forward to the coolness of the night. And then when we got in the coolness of the night, it became so chilly that our teeth even chattered. We looked forward to the warmth of the sun the next morning, and that was continual. You know, it was 4 days before we were spotted, and each day our mouths were swelling. We had no water. We had no food. And eventually there was very little talking going on. And those that got to the point where they really needed some liquid would drink salt water. And I'm telling you, you've never seen anybody go berserk as you would somebody that drank salt water. It was worse than the worst alcoholic drunk that you've ever seen. You couldn't stand them to be near you because our skin was so sore, and they were thrashing and trying to get over or climbing onto the rafts and so forth. And it was terrible.
Harold Bray, the other thing, of course, that everybody remembers about the Indianapolis is the sharks. When was the first time you saw one?
The first day. They just came in droves. There wasn't one. There was a lot of them. And they were hitting the guys, no matter if they were singles or if you're in a group. They just hit whoever they could come up upon.
And remind us again, you're clinging to a net that's being held afloat by cork, so you're, the water's up to your shoulders.
All the time. Yeah, it got, like Paul said, it got so bad that you couldn't touch anything because your skin would roll off after 3 days. It was just, it was a pretty terrible sight.
And you know those fish are in there.
Yeah. They come back every day. They always were hungry, I guess. It was just a terrible sight to see somebody next to you get hit by one of those things.
When that happened, did they just go away? Were they grabbed and taken below?
Yes, most of them. Well, some of them would bob back up, but it wasn't all there.
Paul, was that your experience as well?
Well, you know, I came from Missouri, and I didn't know what sharks looked like. I thought they might be catfish or something. But the schools came around us, and generally we splashed and hollered, and they seemed to let us alone for a while. They bumped our legs and stuff like that. But, I found that sharks do not like Irishmen. And so I was okay.
When you feel that bump, though, of one of those sharks in the water bumping your legs, I mean, your stomach's got to fall right through your body.
Well, we got to the point where it might not have mattered. We had to look at it sensibly. Are we going to be saved or are we not? And you got to prepare for mentally for what might happen. And I think many of us were ready either way that it went. Fortunately, we were lucky enough to be spotted, and rescues soon came, at least within 12 hours after that.
We'll have more with Harold Bray and Paul Murphy of the USS Indianapolis Survivors Association in the second half of our show. I'm Neil Conan. This is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. And from Wilmington Trust, a wealth management company providing investment and trust services to individuals, families, and corporations nationwide for nearly 100 years. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Rescued at Sea. We continue our conversation with Paul Murphy and Harold Bray, survivors of the USS Indianapolis, which was torpedoed near the end of the Second World War. Also, John Powers reviews the new thriller, The Deep End.
Mm-hmm. told me it was so. A million dreams ago, you held me.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Neil Conan, filling in for Terry Gross. Last month, the U.S. Navy exonerated Captain Charles McVeigh, who'd been blamed for the loss of the USS Indianapolis near the end of World War II. Let's get back to our conversation with Harold Bray and Paul Murphy, who were shipmates on the Indianapolis. The Navy didn't realize that the ship was missing. Only 317 men survived dehydration, hypothermia, and shark attacks as they prayed for rescue. You guys didn't have any, survival equipment, no lights, no flasks of water, no food, no nothing?
Nothing. Well, we had the raft that we had. I think they had a water jug, but it was empty or full of salt water or something, from what I gather. We didn't have any of that. I think there was a can of malted milk pills
tablets.
Something, yeah. It was supposed to be in the kit in the raft, and whoever was supposed to take care of those, I guess, didn't get around to that raft. There was nothing but that malted milk pills or tablets that I saw, and they passed those out, but not much energy in those.
Harold, was there, as you've thought about it all these years later, was there one moment that sticks out where you really thought about giving it up?
Yeah, but the fourth day, I don't believe they would have found many if Gwen didn't come along on the fourth day. I don't think another day in the water, I doubt if they would have found too many of us.
I don't think anybody would have known what happened to the Indianapolis in another 24 hours.
Everybody was getting pretty wore out and weak.
But when that moment arrived, what were you thinking about?
I was thinking about probably at home.
Paul Murphy, was there a moment like that for you?
Well, I knew that I had reason to live if it was all possible, because my mother was in the hospital back in Missouri. And I knew that if anything happened to me, it would probably be disastrous for her. I have three brothers, and I always told my brothers that I was mother's favorite. So I had no girlfriends or anything like that, but I did have family back home that I was concerned about. But I did act sensibly about our situation. I had reached a point where it didn't make any difference one way or the other. If it was to be okay, and if it wasn't, Lord help me. And he did.
When did you guys first realize that that help was on the way?
When we saw the airplane. You know what? I never did see Gwen.
Who's Gwen?
That was the pilot that found us.
He was a pilot of the PVC-1. Yeah. It was a two-engine bomber out looking for submarines. That's a story in itself, Neil. Want me to elaborate a little bit on it?
Please.
Chuck Gwynn has always been called our angel. As he was approaching our area, they were testing a radio antenna out the bottom of the plane, which gave them longer distances to their home base. And just before he got to our area, one of the cables that this was suspended from became loose, and it flopped around in the air. The pilot, Chuck, came back to the plane, got down on his belly, looked through the hole in the plane, and was intending to correct this antenna, but he saw oil slick in the water. And as he was approaching, he thought it was a Japanese submarine that might be in trouble, and he ran back to his seat and opened the bomb bay doors up and was making a bombing run on that area. And then as he became lower in altitude, approximately 2,000 feet, his crew saw heads bobbing in the water, and they realized that there was a disaster of some sort. And he immediately wired back to his base, and that message went to the sub-commander of the base, and he sent one PBY out with supplies.
That was Catalina plane.
Yes, and then as he got out to our area, which took probably an hour and a half to 2 hours, he started dropping supplies and life rafts and kegs of water and so forth. And his crew also saw that the men were scattered out over about a 25-mile area, and that especially those that were stragglers or off by themselves were being attacked by sharks. He wired back to his base in Peleliu, and they sent one more PBY out. So we had two of them flying over us. The first one that was out there was flown by Adrian Marks from Frankfort, Indiana, and he decided that in order to save some lives, he would have to break Navy regulations and land in 8 to 12-foot swells and start picking up the men. The other pilot was directing him as Marks landed, popped some rivets, and as he was approaching the various stragglers, which he decided was the best to do for the situation, the other one directed him from the air, and he started picking up survivors, and he picked up 56 men in a small plane like that, piled them in the aisle like cordwood, tied the rest of them on the wings with parachute shrouds, and that was the first time they found out that the USS Indianapolis had sunk and nobody was looking for it. And Adrian Marks did one other rule breaking. He radioed all ships in the area his location, told them to proceed at once to pick up survivors. Didn't say who it was. And the ships then started coming in on late Thursday afternoon and didn't arrive there until after dark. But the Doyle was the first one on the site, and it had its lights, searchlights shining against the clouds so that everybody knew help was on the way. And then the Bassett was the next ship on the scene, and it started up picking up the groups that Harold and I were in. And they picked up 151 men and took us to Samar in the Philippines for the hospitals. And before we got there, two of those men died en route. That was terrible. And they were later buried on Samara.
Harold, as Paul just mentioned, you were in that big group. Did you get that last day some of the supplies that were dropped from the air? And what were your feelings?
Backing up to Chuck Gwynn, when he spotted us, he dropped what I thought was a canister of water. And I left the group and I swam out to it. And it was an antenna. It was a submarine detector. And just before Chuck died a couple of years ago, he told me that I could have talked to him. There was a microphone on the end of this wire going down to the ocean.
It was a sono buoy. It was good to pick up the sound of a submarine.
Right. And when I did that, it was I don't know how far away I swam from the group, but at that time, I looked back, there was all kinds of noise going on, so I thought they were being hit by sharks. So there was another raft off, I don't know, another 100 yards or so from where I was. There was two guys on it. So I went over to that one, and I don't know, I sort of remember them taking this raft apart and trying to make a sail or something and sail away into the shipping lanes or some kind of stuff. Anyhow, I got on this raft, and there was no bottom in it because they had tore the slats out trying to make a sail. And sometime during the night, these two guys disappeared. I don't know what happened to them. I never did see them again. But I was alone on the raft when I got picked up by the Bassett. I think I was probably the first one that the Bassett picked up and put me on a LCV, or it was a landing craft anyhow that came out and picked me up.
And, yeah, they use those like life.
Like lifeboats.
Like lifeboats. Yeah. I think there was two or three of them out there circulating around and picking up boys. Then they come alongside the ship.
And when you got on the ship, was the first thing that you wanted a drink of water?
Well, the first thing they did for us, they put me in one of those basket things, you know, and the ship, the water was kind of rough as I remember it. And this LC landing craft would go down and the ship would go up and then they'd jerk you up in this basket. That was a wild ride. They've got me on then they put me on some kind of a operating table, and I thought this was a hospital ship or something. And there's questions like, you got any broken bones, and they checked you out. And then the next thing I knew was I was in the shower all cleaned up. I don't know how that happened, but everybody worked on you, I guess.
Paul, obviously by that point, a lot of the men were in very bad shape, delirious.
Yes, the crew can attest to that. I know when I came alongside the ship, they pulled me aboard this landing craft, and I thought I could climb the rope ladder, and I got up a couple of rungs, and I fell off, and they put me in this wire basket that Harold was referring to. It took me up to the quarter deck, and they laid me out on the deck and cut off my clothes because we were black, just covered with oil, and they cut off my clothes, and somebody carried me into the shower, and they laid me on the floor or deck in the shower, and we scrubbed the oil off of us the best they could, and the crew gave up their bunks, and I'm telling you, they were all nice white bunks, and it was a beautiful ship, and they threw us up on their bunks, and we left them in a mess, and they started giving us a little water and some oranges, the best tasting oranges I have ever had in my life.
Paul Murphy and Harold Bray of the USS Indianapolis Survivors Association. More of their story after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's hear more with Harold Bray and Paul Murphy, U.S. sailors who survived the sinking of the USS Indianapolis in World War II. There seemed to be a period after the war when this story was not mentioned. I know the Navy was, well, at least according to what a lot of people believe, covering up the story and the responsibility and who was at fault for the ship being there and who was at fault for not knowing it had gone down. And really, that's another story. But you guys amongst yourselves, were you telling the story? Was this something that you lived with, or was it something you tried to forget?
May I answer that?
Go ahead.
I think most World War II veterans, when they came home, they were visiting with classmates and friends at home that had been in the service. And you couldn't tell whether you were talking to somebody that had it worse than you, so you kept your mouth shut. We never talked about it. We wanted to forget it. It wasn't until we started our reunions in 1960 that our camaraderie came together and we started talking about it. My own children never knew anything about it until about 1980.
Harold Bray, you worked as a police officer. Didn't it ever come up?
Oh, yeah, well, it was kind of a funny thing. We were in the coffee room one day. I never mentioned it to any of the guys. And my best golf buddy now, he was in the radio room or the coffee room that day. And we were talking about this movie, The Jaws. And they were talking about it, and I was just listening. And this buddy of mine, Bob, says, boy, that was a hell of a story this guy told. He mentioned the Indianapolis and the sharks and stuff. I said, well, I was on that ship. He said, no way. Then that's how they found out that I was on the ship.
a lot of people became familiar with the story of the Indianapolis from the movie Jaws. We have a clip from that movie. If you'll remember, this is the actor Robert Shaw, is the great shark hunter, and he's out in the water. He's got Richard Dreyfuss and Roy Scheider there as the chief of police from Amity. And he describes his experience and his animus for sharks because he was a crew member of the USS Indianapolis.
Japanese submarine slammed two torpedoes into our side, Chief. He was coming back from the island of Tinian to Lady and just delivered the bomb, the Hiroshima bomb. 1,100 men went into the water. Vessel went down in 12 minutes. Didn't see the first shark for about half an hour. Tiger, 13-footer. You know that when you're in the water, Chief? You tell by looking from the dorsal to the tail. Well, we didn't know. Was our bomb mission had been so secret. No distress signal had been sent. They didn't even list us overdue for a week. Very first light, Chief. Sharks come cruising. So we formed ourselves into tight groups. You know, it's kind of like old squares in a battle, like you see in a calendar, like the Battle of Waterloo, and the idea was, shark comes to the nearest man, that man, he start pounding and hollering and screaming. Sometimes the shark go away. Sometimes he wouldn't go away. Sometimes that shark, he looks right into you, right into your eyes. You know the thing about a shark, he's got lifeless eyes, black eyes, like a doll's eye. Noon the fifth day, Mr. Hooper, Lockheed Ventura. So he swung in low and he saw us, too. The young pilot, a lot younger than Mr. Hooper anyway, he saw us and he come in low. And 3 hours later, a big fat PBY comes down and start to pick us up. You know, that was the time I was most frightened, waiting for my turn. I'll never put on a life jacket again. So 1,100 men went in the war. 316 men come out. The sharks took the rest June the 29th, 1945.
The date there at the end of that clip of Robert Shaw from the movie Jaws, the date is wrong. There are a few other facts in there that are wrong. Paul Murphy, you were one of the men who was actually in the water. Did he get it right in most ways?
He indicated that most of the men that died were died from shark attacks. Most of the men that died from exhaustion, hyperthermia, drinking salt water, and it's hard to estimate how many of them were killed by sharks, but there were some. There's no question about that. But as I said, sharks really don't like Irishmen, and they didn't have me in that group.
I was interested in that thing, though, that he said was that the most terrifying part was right at the end. I guess the fear that you might not get away.
It passed over or something. Yeah. It was a big chance. Like, I was by myself. It was just a miracle that they saw me. You know, I didn't have any lights or nothing on me, and they just come up on me, and they must have been coming into the group from that direction, and I was there. They could have passed me by very easy. They picked up several singles, guys that were by themselves. So. But just one of the lucky guys. I'm not even Irish. I'm Scotch, though. Pretty close.
Is there a day that goes by, Paul Murphy, that you don't now think about what happened all those years ago?
Well, especially when I see planes fly over. I try to shut out as much as I can. But, you know, most of the survivors, thankfully, for the youth of today, want to hear the story. And I think most of the survivors are on kind of a speaking tour. Anybody that has a story to tell about World War II or Korea or any of the others, is the sooner they can talk about it, the better they're going to be off mentally and be able to have a healing. Put it to bed.
Harold Bray, you did not talk about it much.
No. My mother and dad died not knowing what I went through. I never did talk to them about it. Sometimes I wish I would have, but they never asked, so I never told them.
And your kids?
My kids, they've been to, well, they didn't know about it in their young life either. And they've been to a few of our reunions with me. At one time, I think we had the biggest group at the reunion. We had 22 people in my group. We have many reunions, too. We had one at Paul's place last summer, and I think that was more gratifying. We got to be more intimate with people, you know.
We're learning more about each other this way. Yeah. It's kind of a friendly group that gets together, and we get a chance to meet in the hospitality room and discuss families and get better acquainted.
Paul Murphy, thank you very much for sharing your story.
You bet.
Paul Murphy is chairman of the Indianapolis Survivors Association. And Harold Bray, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you for taking us time.
Harold Bray and Paul Murphy, survivors of the sinking of the USS Indianapolis during the Second World War. Last month, the Navy officially exonerated Captain Charles McVeigh of blame for the loss of the ship. Next week, the USS Indianapolis Survivors Association holds its 12th reunion in Indianapolis. Coming up, a review of the new movie, The Deep End. This is Fresh Air. One of the hottest films at this year's Sundance Film Festival was the noirish thriller The Deep End. Critics were calling it Hitchcockian. The film stars the British actress Tilda Swinton. Fresh Air film critic John Powers has a review.
Back when the studios still had some interest in women, they made what were called women's pictures. Stars like Joan Crawford or Betty Davis played heroines, thrust into melodramatic situations that left them swimming in primal emotions. These days, such stories are thought to be slightly embarrassing, corny, and vaguely insulting to women. So we've entered the era of the revisionist women's picture. Movies like Todd Haynes' Safe or Pedro Almodovar's All About My Mother take old-fashioned melodramas, then put a postmodern spin on them. That's just what happens in The Deep End, a smart new movie by Scott McGee and David Siegel, which sounds like a potboiler, but is actually a highly abstract riff on the trickiness of motherhood. Tilda Swinton stars as Margaret Hall, a Lake Tahoe mother of three with the control freak aura of a Martha Stewart. She begins the movie by warning a gay bounder named Darby Reese to keep away from her teenage son, Beau, played by Jonathan Tucker. But the smitten Beau sneaks off with Darby, and before you know it, the bounder's dead. Margaret finds the corpse near her house, and to protect her son, she dumps the body in the lake. But her problems are just beginning. Shortly after the body's found, she receives a visit from a soulful thug named Alec Spera. He's played by ER heartthrob Goran Visnjic. Alec and his partner possess an old videotape of Beau having sex with Darby. If Margaret doesn't cough up 50 grand, they're going to give that tape to the cops. So she begins a desperate attempt to save her son, unassisted by her husband, who's off at sea. But things rapidly spin out of control. Here, Alec visits the house to demand his money.
Did you get the money?
No.
I'm not sure you understand the situation.
We don't have the money.
You have to get the money. Is that not clear enough?
It's $50,000. It is not the kind of thing that everyone can just go out and get.
Have you spoken with your husband?
He can't be reached. He's on a carrier somewhere in the north. This is truly none of your business.
What about the old man? Well, you have to try harder.
Try harder?
I don't think you're really trying.
Really?
Yes.
Well, maybe you should explain really trying to me, Mr. Sparrow. Tell me, how would you be really trying if you were me? But you're not me, are you? You don't have my petty concerns to clutter your life and keep you from trying. You don't have 3 kids to feed or worry about the future of a 17-year-old boy who nearly got himself killed, driving back from some kind of a nightclub with his 30-year-old friend sitting drunk in the seat beside him. No, these are not your concerns. I see that.
Movie buffs will recognize that The Deep End is an updated version of Max Ophüls' 1949 classic, The Reckless Moment, whose heroine was busy saving her daughter. Having Margaret try to save a gay son isn't simply a fashionable trick, though it says something about today's America that we don't even blink at Beau's infatuation with Darby. Rather, the filmmakers are showing us the complex psychosexual dynamics of Margaret's world, with her unreachable husband, her clueless live-in father-in-law, the artistic son she adores, note the name Beau, and the threatening yet alluring villain, Alex Sparrow, who's drawn to her like a lover. Each of these men threatens to shatter the glassy fastidiousness that's apparent in everything from the way she exercises to the neatness of her kitchen. We see all of this in the face of Swinton, the willowy English actress best known for playing iconic figures like Orlando in the movie of the same name. Here she finally gets to act rather than just pose, and she seizes her opportunity. She makes us care about Margaret's brittleness and suppressed emotionalism, her middle-class conventionality and her capacity for heroism. And in the underwater scenes, we marvel at her ability to pull car keys from a dead man's pocket while holding her breath. She's so compelling that one wishes that Vizniach was more than just handsome. Alex, the film's most ambiguous character, a bad man drawn to the good. But neither the script nor the performance give him any juice. In fact, for all the use of water imagery in The Deep End, and it's laid on by the gallon, the movie feels dry, like a Hitchcock thriller with the thrills removed. It's as if McGee and Siegel were so bent on not making an old-fashioned melodrama that they've over-intellectualized everything. The visual style is fussily precise, and there are no quirks or surprises in the acting. The movie's quite brainy, but it holds together too perfectly, as if every single thing was planned in advance, and there was no room for any spontaneity, any mess. In the end, The Deep End isn't simply about a woman who reminds you of Martha Stewart. It seems to have been made by her.
John Powers is executive editor of LA Weekly. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Bob Purdick. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Our researcher is Jessica Chu. Roberta Sharrock directs the show. For Terry Gross, I'm Neil Conan.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Delacorte Press, a division of Random House, publisher of Moon Women by Pamela Duncan, a novel about 3 generations of women in a Southern family. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, the story of the con man and opportunist who brought anesthetic into the operating room and made surgery painless for the first time. Julie Fenster tells us about her new book, Ether Day. Also, The Secret Life of Dust, a talk with Hannah Holmes on the big consequences of small things. I'm Neil Conan. Join us for the next Fresh Air.